The Valley of Fear. There is no time of year more calculated to leave one feeling jaded and drab as the first 5 or 6 days that follow the Christmas and New Year festivities. The first week of January 1889 was no exception. It was depressingly damp, dark, and very cold. My good friend Sherlock Holmes professed daily that he found London life exceedingly dull and uneventful, and he spent most of the time brooding in his chair, smoking a pipe, and growing tense and morose. That was until the morning of January the 6th. Holmes arrived at the breakfast table, late as usual, and looking more sullen and pale than ever. He had been in the habit of leaving his breakfast practically untouched, a fact upon which Mrs. Hudson had commented with some forcefulness. However, no sooner had he glanced at the table than his eyes lit up with expectation. It was not the bowl of Mrs. Hudson's splendid kedgeree that excited him so, but an envelope propped against his breakfast cup. An envelope containing a letter, which it was to turn out was to lead to the unfolding of one of the most remarkable and chilling stories I have ever had the privilege to record in my journal.
A letter from Porlock, Watson. I thought I read the postmark as Camberwell rather than Somerset, Holmes.
Ah, indeed you did, Watson. Indeed you did. But my Porlock is a person, not a place. Mm-hmm. And it is his handwriting, that peculiar flourish to the Greek E. There, on the envelope. Posted, as you so rightly point out, in Camberwell.
Yeah, of course.
Who is Porlock? Porlock is an alias, a nom de plume, a mere identification mark. The man himself is just one link in a long chain, but the man on the end of the chain is the most dangerous of them all. Moriarty.
I see.
That is why Porlock's letter is so important, Watson. He is the only flaw in the chain, and we must respond. Take a look. What do you make of it?
534. C2, 13, 31, 7, Douglas, 27, Burlston. Well, it's short. You shouldn't take too long to crack it once you've got the key.
There is no key.
But then how...
The cipher key is a crude device, isn't far too dangerous to use in trying to trap an adversary of the caliber of Professor Moriarty.
So, we have here an important secret that is indecipherable.
Not at all, Watson. Porlock's references to a book. One does not need a key to this cipher, only the name of a book. I would normally have expected Porlock to have sent the name of the book under separate cover. As you can see, there has been no other letter. I can only assume that Moriarty is closing in fast on our man, and he fears even to send a second letter.
Which means we are still at a complete loss.
Perhaps there are points which have escaped your Machiavellian intellect, Watson. The message before you begins with the number 534, does it not?
Yes.
Let us take as a working hypothesis, then, the notion that the number 534 refers to a particular page.
Yes.
Therefore, we are looking for a particularly large book. The next sign is C2.
Chapter 2?
Hardly, Watson. You will, I am sure, agree with me that if page 534 finds us but in the second chapter, the length of the first must have been intolerable.
Yeah.
Besides, if we have a page number, a chapter number is superfluous.
Column.
Watson, you are scintillating this morning. A large book printed in double columns and in common usage.
The Bible, perhaps.
Good, Watson, good. But not good enough.
Oh.
I can hardly think of any volume less likely to be found at the elbow of one of Professor Moriarty's associates. And consider the number of different editions of Holy Writ that exist. No, this must be a book that is standardized. Porlock knows that his page 534 will correspond with our page 534.
Bradshaw's railway timetable?
The vocabulary in Bradshaw is nervous and tense, but limited. Much more likely to be something like an almanac. Whitaker's, for example.
Yes.
Here we are. Page 534. Column 2. What is the next sign, Watson?
13.
The 13th word is there. And?
31 and 7.
31 is danger.
The next sign is the word Douglas.
Go on.
27.
There is danger, Douglas, at Burlston. That's it, Watson. Come. Ah, Mrs. Hudson.
Inspector MacDonald is downstairs, sir.
Is he, by Jove? Then show him up, Mrs. Hudson. Show him up.
I take it then that you've finished your breakfast.
Yes, 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 of course.
And the ketchery was, as always, splendid, Mrs. Hudson.
Yes. Well.
Inspector Mack is one of the sharper members of the Scotland Yard Detective Force.
You think he's wanting some help on a new case?
And he did seem particularly gratified by the assistance I gave him a few months ago in the case of the Albanian organ grinder.
Good morning, Mr. Holmes.
Ah, Inspector Mack. You know my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson.
Good morning, sir.
Inspector.
I fear your visit means that there is some mischief afoot, Inspector.
I think it would be nearer the truth, Mr. Holmes, if you said hope rather than fear.
A sharp observation as always, Inspector Mack. But we have a mystery for you. Eh, Watson?
Indeed.
Dr. Watson and I have been working on a little case concerning this message which arrived for me earlier this morning.
Ah. 534 C2.
We have deciphered the code, Watson.
There is danger. Douglas at Burlston.
Douglas at Burlston?
Yes. Do these names mean something to you, Inspector?
Simply that the Burlston affair is my case. And Mr. Jack Douglas of Burlston Manor House, Burlston, Sussex, was found murdered this morning.
What?
He'd had his face blown away by a sawn-off shotgun.
My God.
Remarkable.
You don't seem surprised.
Interested, Mr. Mack, but hardly surprised. I receive an anonymous communication from a quarter I know to be important, warning me that danger threatens a certain person. Within an hour, I learn that this danger has actually materialized and that the person is dead. Thus, I am interested, but as you observe, Mr. Mack, I am not surprised.
Yeah. It does seem to be in a particularly horrible murder, Holmes.
Have you further details, Mr. Mack?
All I have is the official requisition for Scotland Yard assistance and a personal note from White Mason, the local officer. It arrived on the milk train this morning. Mm. White Mason is an old friend.
I'll read it, Watson.
Mac, this one's particularly extraordinary. You would think the whole thing had been set up for theatrical effect if it weren't for a man with his face blown off in the middle of it. If you can, bring Mr. Holmes, for he will find something after his own heart. It's a real snorter, this one.
Your friend is obviously no fool, Mr. Mac.
Are you still interested, Mr. Holmes?
Watson and I will be but 5 minutes. Have a cab ready, Inspector.
I already have one waiting.
In no time at all, Holmes and I had packed small travelling bags, donned jackets, hats and greatcoats, and joined Inspector MacDonald in the hansom.
Mr. Holmes, are you and Dr. Watson returning for supper or not?
That would appear to be a highly unlikely circumstance, Mrs. Hudson.
Victoria Railway Station, driver.
With haste.
White Mason will be glad you've decided to join us in this one, Mr. Holmes.
It does seem to have been a particularly vicious sort of crime.
It also seems to have been a crime with the smell of Moriarty about it.
Sounds as if you've solved it already, Mr. Holmes. You know, the Scotland Yard lads feel you've got a bit of a bee in your bonnet over this, Professor. I haven't told you this, have I? And following your last tip, I went to see the Professor.
I'm pleased to hear it.
Hmm. And a very learned, talented, and respectable sort of man he seems to be.
Oh, I do not doubt the extent of his learning. I do not doubt the extent of his talent or the semblance of respectability. But tell me, Mr. Mack, what did he look like to you?
He had grey hair and the most wonderful way with words. Very solemn. When he put his hand on my shoulder as we were parting, it was like a father's blessing.
Is that so?
I thought at the time that he would have made a grand minister of the Kirk.
But what did he look like, Mr. Mack? Describe his face.
Kind of thin, I think.
This most pleasing and touching of interviews took place, no doubt, in the professor's study.
Aye.
You sat in front of his writing desk?
So.
With the sun in your eyes and his face in the shadow.
The inspector sat frowning in silence for the last 10 minutes of the ride to Victoria Station. Our train had hardly crossed an icy-looking River Thames before Holmes pursued his point again.
Did you happen to observe a picture hanging above the professor's head?
Oh, I don't miss much, Mr. Holmes. Yes, I saw the picture. A picture of a young woman, head on hands, peering at you out of the corner of her eye.
Jean-Baptiste Gers, La Jeune Fille à l'Agneau.
Oh.
Sold at the Port Salis sale in 1885 for £4,000.
Oh, that's a lot of money.
According to the standard books of reference, Professor Moriarty's annual salary is £700. As for his family, his brother works as a station master for the Somerset and Dorset Railway Company.
Then how could he afford...
Exactly.
Leaning back in his seat with the satisfied air of a leading prosecuting counsel who has just proven his case, Holmes began to fill his pipe. The inspector sat thoughtfully, and an uneasy silence descended upon the compartment. We were already approaching the rolling downland of Sussex before the inspector spoke again.
You told me, Mr. Holmes, that you had never met Professor Moriarty.
That particular pleasure does still await me.
Then how come you described his study to me just now?
Twice now, I have had occasion to visit the professor's apartment while he was away on business. There were certain papers in his safe which I needed to consult.
You mean you broke in?
I fear, Mr. Mack, that I will never be considered by you as having the right qualities to make a grand minister of the Kirk.
And no more was said on the subject for the rest of the journey. Our train reached Birlstone sometime after 12 o'clock, and as we stepped onto the platform, a ruddy-faced man with bandy and gaitered legs came running towards us. I took him at first to be a local farmer or retired gamekeeper.
MacDonald!
Ah, there's White Mason.
MacDonald, how are you?
Fine, just fine. Yeah. White Mason, this is Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. White Mason.
Pleasure.
It's a great honor to have you with us, Mr. Holmes. Max, tell me all about your work on the case of the Albanian organ grinder.
Indeed.
But this Birlstone affair, I tell you, it's a real snorter.
Birlstone was a small cluster of half-timbered cottages on the northern borders of the Sussex Weald. The nearest place of any importance was Tunbridge Wells, some 10 miles to the east over the border into Kent. We deposited our bags at the Westville Arms, the only inn in the village. After a light lunch, we set out for Birlstone Manor, which lay about half a mile from the village proper.
There it is, gentlemen. Through the trees there. Dates back to the Crusades, you know.
But mainly Jacobean.
Yes.
The preponderance of gables and diamond-paned windows suggest as much.
A moat, too. And a drawbridge.
It's a regular little fortress.
The drawbridge is raised each evening at 6 o'clock, and lowered again in the morning.
A man who appreciated tradition, was he, Mr. Douglas?
Well, he bought the place after making a fortune in the Californian gold fields. But he subscribed to all the right charities, sang a fine tenor at village concerts, sat on committees for this and that, made himself into a very popular sort of country squire.
And is there a Mrs. Douglas?
Yes, she's his second wife. A tall, a rather striking woman with a lively...
And servants?
Oh, none that need concern us, apart from Ames, the butler. There's plenty round here who'll vouch for him.
No doubt.
There is one other person at the house, a Mr. Cecil James Barker, Douglas's former colleague in California. Now, I know one shouldn't listen to village gossip...
But one should, Mr. White Mason.
Well, apparently he and Mrs. Douglas have been seen...
Sir! Mr. White Mason, sir!
Oh, steady on, lad, steady on.
I found some evidence, sir. In them bushes, sir. See? It's bicycle, sir. I think it's evidence, sir. I think it's the bicycle he used to get away with, sir. Or rather, it isn't. Else if he'd have used it to get away with, it wouldn't still be here.
Thank you, Constable. You can leave this to us.
Thank you, sir.
Rudge Whitworth de Lukes. Well used, too. Now, why should our murderer abandon his means of escape, huh?
I said it was a snorter.
You did indeed, Mr. White Mason. You did indeed.
We made our way across the drawbridge and into the house. White Mason took us straight into the study. It was a dreadful sight. There were dark red stains splashed across all four walls, the ceiling and the floor. Of the dead man's face, no features at all could be recognized. He lay sprawling with outstretched limbs in the center of the room, clad in his night attire and pink dressing gown. Across his chest lay a sawn-off shotgun.
That's a mighty gruesome-looking sort of weapon.
double-barreled, with the triggers wired together for maximum effect.
A tool not uncommon among a certain sort of criminal, particularly in the United States of America.
You can just make out the letters P-E-N along the sawn-off end of the barrel. You see?
Ah, yes. A rather clumsy Gothic script. Pennsylvania Small Arms Company.
Good Lord.
This footprint on the windowsill is of interest, too. It's dried blood and from a very broad foot. A very broad foot indeed. Watson, you're not attempting to carry out a post-mortem over there?
No, there's not much need for that, I'm afraid. It's this mark on the forearm here.
Ah, a tattoo, is it? Very poorly executed.
Not much of a design, either. A brown triangle and a brown circle. Ames says it's always been there as long as he can remember.
This mark's not been made with a tattoo needle. No. This unfortunate gentleman has been branded.
Huh? You mean with a...
In exactly the same way as they do cattle. Yes.
A dreadful thing.
Remarkable.
Luncheon has been cleared away, sir. And the dining room is ready for your use.
Oh, thank you, Ames. Is there something else?
It's just that when I saw the poor master's body, I thought there was something wrong. But it wasn't until I, had another look that I realized his wedding ring is missing. He wore a wedding ring with a smaller nugget ring above on the same finger.
Well, the nugget ring is still here.
Do you mean to tell me that the attacker first took off the nugget ring, then the wedding ring, and then put the nugget ring back?
He must have done.
I think we're looking for a mighty queer fish here, Mr. Holmes.
At the moment, I am looking for the other dumbbell.
The what?
There is only one dumbbell on the table here. Our man has made off with a dumbbell and a wedding ring.
But he has left his bicycle behind.
I said it.
Might it not
a...
be a good idea if we were now to meet Mr. Cecil Barker in the dining room?
Mr. Cecil Barker was tall, dark, and rather loose-jointed. Although not surprisingly, I detected some signs of tiredness and tension about his eyes. He spoke to us calmly and unfalteringly.
I think it's obvious. This villain made his way into the house during the day while the drawbridge was down and secreted himself in the study, picked his moment, and then made his way out through the open window. There is a dark red footprint on the sill.
There is also a bicycle in the bushes. Are you of the opinion, then, that this intruder was a common thief? Who killed Mr. Douglas as a result of being disturbed, and then proceeded to steal his wedding ring, while, of course, replacing a nugget ring on his finger.
Mr. Holmes, for 5 years I mined with Jack Douglas in California. We did well. Very well. But 6 years ago, for no apparent reason, he suddenly sold out and returned to England. Within a week of his leaving the claim, half a dozen men came up looking for him, and they weren't well-wishers.
Can you remember anything of these men?
Well, they were Americans, but not Californians. Rough-looking bunch. There was one striking feature about them, though. They each of them had their right sleeves rolled up, and on each of their right forearms was a brand mark. Hmm. A brown triangle within a brown circle.
Like the one on Douglas's arm?
Exactly. Now, I know Jack had been a member of some secret brotherhood out east, and from what I gathered from the little he told me, there had been a feud. This feud seemed to shadow his whole life. That's why, when he returned to England and remarried, he chose to live in a Jacobean fortress. That's why he raised the drawbridge every night. That's why he double-checked all doors and windows. And that is why he was killed.
It's a desperate kind of secret society that pursues its enemies to the death over a period of 11 years.
Did he ever mention any names?
None.
None, Mr. Holmes.
Eleanor!
Save the name of Bodymaster McGinty.
Eleanor, you should still be resting.
Pray, do come in, Mrs. Douglas.
Eleanor, you can speak to me.
Go on, Mrs. Douglas. Go on.
It was only the once that he ever spoke about it. He was delirious at the time. He'd had a riding accident. Am I still in the valley of fear? He kept moaning. Will Bodymaster McGinty reach me yet?
That is all.
That is all. I always knew Jack to be a man with something on his mind. But 2 days ago he returned from a trip to Tunbridge Wells with a kind of fear in his eyes that I'd not seen before. I've no doubt who was responsible for killing my husband.
Eleanor! Come along, Eleanor. Let me take you back to your room.
Jack, did that seem to be the performance of a grieving widow? Those two are in it together. Mark my words. And I mean together. Young wife and her lover doing away with a poor betrayed husband. I've seen it all before. All we need now is some hard and fast evidence.
My method of working is to find a theory to fit the available evidence, rather than to find evidence to match the first available theory, Mr. Mack. Meet me in the study in 5 minutes. I intend to conduct a small experiment.
Despite my most natural instincts, I could not help but agree with the inspector. I had expected the figure of Mrs. Douglas to be a tragic and distracted one. But the finely molded hand which this beautiful and self-assured woman had placed upon the edge of the table had been as steady as my own. While White Mason, who was fast turning out to be a regular general, marched off to inspect his constabulary, the inspector and I made our way to the study.
Ah, Watson.
Holmes.
Inspector.
Holmes.
I have here one carpet sliver. Property, courtesy of Ames, of Mr. Cecil Barker. And, if I am not mistaken, there. It fits the print on the windowsill exactly.
Good heavens.
One can even detect traces of dried blood on the sole.
Yes, you're right.
You would, of course, have noticed the extraordinary breadth of Mr. Barker's feet as he stood in the dining room.
Further evidence against him. I knew I could rely on you, Mr. Holmes. They've been leading us on a merry dance with all this secret society nonsense. No doubt they planted the bicycle as well. It's a simple case of domestic violence. How does that strike you for a theory, Mr. Holmes?
Perfectly sound, my dear Inspector, providing it can take account of how Porlock came to hear of the Douglases' unfortunate domestic circumstances.
Unless Barker's part of your professor's little gang. And if she's involved, too, we need look no further than this house.
MacDonald. Ah, Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson, too. Good. I've just received a telegram from the police station at Tunbridge Wells. The Mount Ephraim Hotel have reported one of their guests missing. He was last seen yesterday morning heading in the direction of Bolston on a Rudge Whitworth bicycle.
Damn.
It looks, Inspector, as if you will need to look at least as far as Tunbridge Wells.
Following White Mason and MacDonald's departure for Tunbridge Wells, Holmes announced that he had one or two routine matters of investigation that he wanted to clear up. This was his way of indicating that he wished to pursue whatever extraordinary thought was in his mind alone. And so, after arranging to meet him for high tea in the Westville Arms, I decided to try and give some peace to my somewhat jangled nerves by taking a stroll in the curious old-world garden which flanked the house. Rows of ancient yew trees, cut into strange designs, girded it round. Inside was a beautiful stretch of lawn with an old sundial in the middle, and the whole effect was so soothing and restful that the vision of the darkened study with the blood-stained figure on the floor seemed like some dreadful and distant nightmare. I had almost reached the bottommost hedge when I heard the sound of voices on the far side of it. A remark in the deep tones of a man was answered by a little ripple of feminine laughter. I hastened towards a small opening.
Dr. Watson, I fear you will think me callous and hard-hearted.
I'm pleased to see you looking so well, Mrs. Douglas.
I hope that someday you will be able to do me justice.
Come along, Eleanor. You have already said enough.
Dr. Watson, if only you knew...
There is no reason why Dr. Watson should know, Eleanor. It is no possible business of his.
If it is no business of mine, then I beg leave to resume my walk. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Doctor.
I arrived back at the Westville Arms rather early, but Holmes was already there, sitting in an ingle nook, a pipe in his mouth, reading through some papers. I immediately told him of my encounter with Barker and Mrs. Douglas.
A lie, Watson. The whole story is a great, big, thumping, obtrusive, uncompromising lie. And the incident you have just related to me merely confirms it. Look, I have here the statements made by Barker and Mrs. Douglas to the police. And they forced me to the same conclusion. Listen, Watson. What do you make of this? 10:30. Barker in the guest room and Mrs. Douglas in her own room hear a shot from the study. Barker gets there first, rings furiously for Ames, who, being in the basement at the far end of the house, has heard nothing. Confronts Mrs. Douglas in time to prevent her entering the study. At which point, Ames arrives, and Barker persuades her to return to her room.
That all seems quite clear.
Too clear by half. Watson, I am not, as you are aware, a wholehearted admirer of womankind. But my experience of life has taught me that no wife who had any concern for her husband would, on being told that he was dead, simply and quietly, return to her room at the request of a household guest.
You think, then, that poor Douglas was indeed murdered by his wife and the man Barker?
There is, Watson, an appalling directness about your question. They come at me like bullets. If you put it that do I think Barker and Mrs. Douglas are conspiring to conceal the truth about the murder, then the answer is simple. Yes, I do. But your more deadly proposition is not clear. Let us assume they are Moriarty's agents. They plant a bicycle, a false footprint, and a disappearing hotel guest. That is as far as we get before all the untidy, angular, uncompromising bits come into play and refuse to slip into place. Why a sawn-off shotgun, a noisy and unwieldy weapon? Why remove the wedding ring? Why steal a dumbbell? As to the discarded bicycle, well, even the dullest detective must ask why should a man keen to get away leave his bicycle behind?
I must admit, I can conceive of no explanation.
Besides, professional crimes of the caliber of Moriarty's agents do not leave untidy or uncompromising bits behind them.
But there must be a Moriarty connection. I mean, Porlock's message.
Exactly. Leaving aside for one moment the murderer's bizarre interest in his victim's wedding ring, consider for a moment the following scenario. Barker and the wife reach the room together. Moriarty's assassin convinces them that any attempt to arrest him would lead to the exposure of some hideous scandal. They agree. He takes the wedding ring for whatever reason, and they let him out over the drawbridge before raising the alarm. Then, again assuming the two are lovers, they desperately attempt to throw down false leads to cover up what they perceive will be seen by the police as a domestic crime.
Well, the weight of the available evidence would certainly seem to support such an interpretation.
The weight of the evidence. Watson, you're a genius! The dumbbell, of course. I think an evening spent alone in the study could be of great help.
You are going to sit in that place alone?
Not at this precise moment, Watson. No. First, a little high tea is called for. What would you say to 3 or 4 eggs? Lightly poached.
It was nightfall before the inspector and White Mason returned from Tunbridge Wells. They were in exultant mood and reported what they considered to be a great advance in the investigation.
The man staying at the Mount Ephraim Hotel called himself Hargrave. There is no doubt that the Rudge Whitworth bicycle is his. His only other possession seems to have been a small valise, big enough to carry a sawn-off shotgun. The hotel manager said that this man Hargrave spoke with an American accent. There is no doubt that he is tied up in this somehow.
What puzzles me, Mr. Holmes, is that one would have imagined the fellow would have returned to the hotel as an inoffensive tourist. As it is, he must have known that he would have been reported as missing by the hotel manager and his disappearance linked with the murder.
Once we've got him, we can ask the man himself. Descriptions have been circulated throughout the country to all ports. Someone will spot him sooner or later. The watching eye of the British public is a reliable and powerful weapon, Mr. Holmes.
I prefer to rely on the power of analytical and deductive thought, which is why I propose to make a little investigation of my own tonight.
The entire resources of the Sussex Police Force are at your disposal, Mr. Holmes.
Thank you, but the cover of darkness and the use of Dr. Watson's large umbrella will be sufficient for my needs.
But that's no kind of weapon. It could be dangerous.
If I thought there was any chance of danger, my dear Watson, I should certainly ask for your assistance. As it is, I merely ask for your umbrella. Thank you. And now, I bid you good night, gentlemen.
Good night, Holmes. I retired to bed, totally exhausted by the day's events. My deep sleep was disturbed only by dreams, in which I was falling into a dark, red, sticky mess, while above a beautiful woman stood, her face quivering with little ripples of feminine laughter. When I awoke, the early morning sun was pouring through the bedroom window. We took breakfast quickly and made our way to the small cottage, which was the home of the local police sergeant. Inspector MacDonald and Mr. White Mason were surrounded by telegrams.
Well, Inspector, has our villain been spotted?
He has.
Well, tell us, man, where?
Leicester.
Leicester?
Aye, Leicester. He has also been spotted in Nottingham, Southampton, East Ham, Tullicutri, Torquay, and 14 other places.
And he's been arrested in Liverpool and Bristol.
Dear me. Your faith in the inquisitiveness of the British public seems to have been somewhat too well rewarded, Inspector. You will be pleased to know that my investigations last night enabled me to draw one or two deductions.
Well?
My advice to you is, abandon the case.
What?
Oh, you consider it hopeless?
I consider your case hopeless. You will not find your missing bicyclist in Torquay or Tullicutri.
You are holding something back, Mr. Holmes.
You know my methods, Mr. Mack. I need to verify the details, which can be very readily done, after which I will take my bow and return to London, leaving my results entirely at your service.
And what do you propose we do now?
Write a short note to Mr. Barker. I'll dictate it to you, if you like.
Go on.
Dear sir, in the hope of finding something which may bear upon our investigation, I have made arrangements to have the moat drained.
We can't do that.
And our workmen will be starting first thing tomorrow morning. I hope this doesn't inconvenience you, blah, blah, blah.
But we haven't got any workmen.
Well, whatever you do, don't tell Barker that. Be sure Mr. Barker receives that note, Inspector.
And then?
And then a most instructive hour or so can be spent reading a modest little account of the building of Burlston Manor, purchasable at the very reasonable sum of one penny from the local tobacconist.
Oh, you're making fools of us, Mr. Holmes.
Breadth of view is one of the essentials of our profession. The interplay of ideas and the oblique uses of knowledge are often of extraordinary interest. Spend your day as you will, Inspector. But meet me here at 4 o'clock this afternoon, without fail.
The inspector and Mr. White Mason walked off with a mixture of curiosity, annoyance, and frustration on their faces. Their countenances had not changed markedly when we all met up again at 4 o'clock. Holmes' news that we were to spend the evening hiding in the grounds of Burlston Manor did not improve tempers. It was a damp and bitterly cold January night. We made our way up to the manor and followed Holmes into a shrubbery almost opposite the main door and drawbridge, which was, I noticed, open. We also had a good view of the study window. Taking Holmes' example, we crouched down in the laurels.
I wish you'd do us the courtesy, Mr. Holmes, of explaining why all this is necessary.
Ah. Our profession, Mr. Mack, would be a drab and sordid one if we did not sometimes set the scene to glorify our results. The blunt accusation. The brutal tap upon the shoulder. What can one make of such a denouement? But at the present moment, you thrill with the glamour of the situation and the anticipation of the hunter.
At the moment, all I anticipate is catching my death of cold.
Ah. Our vigil was a long and bitter one. A cold, damp reek from the moat chilled us to the bones and set our teeth chattering. A single lamp over the gateway and a globe of light in the study glowed steadily. Everything else was dark and still.
Just how long, Mr. Holmes, is this going to last?
If criminals scheduled their movements like railway trains, it would certainly be more convenient for all of us. As it is...
As Holmes was speaking, the study window was thrown open, and the dark outline of a man's head and shoulders peered out into the gloom. He leaned forward, and in the intense silence we were aware of the soft lapping of agitated water. Suddenly, he hauled a large round bundle out of the moat and in through the open window.
Now, come on! The study!
Once over the drawbridge, Holmes rang furiously at the bell, and the door was answered almost immediately by Ames. We rushed into the study and confronted the man Barker.
What the devil do you mean by charging in here like this?
What we mean to do, Mr. Barker, is to have a look inside the bundle you have just raised from the bottom of the moat.
What business is it of yours?
Simply that I put it there.
What? You put it?
To be more accurate, I replaced it there. When water is near and a weight, in this case, a dumbbell is missing, it is not a very far-fetched supposition that something has been sunk in the water. With the help of the admirable Ames and Dr. Watson's umbrella, I was able to fish up this bundle last night and have a look at it. The note which Inspector MacDonald delivered this morning had the desired effect of panicking into action the person who originally hid it.
Well, I'm blessed.
Voila, Inspector. One set of gentleman's clothes.
The cyclist.
Quite so, Watson. You will notice a small grease mark on the bottom of the right trouser leg here. And notice also the name of Neil Outfitters, Vermissa Valley, USA, on the overcoat.
Mr. Barker, I must ask you to accompany me to the police station, where certain charges will be made against you in relation to the death of a person
unknown. You will get nothing to stick on Mr. Barker, Inspector.
And why not, may I ask?
Because I killed your missing cyclist.
An oak panel in the wall immediately behind Barker had slid open, and there appeared before us a man. He was, I would guess, in his early 50s. He was tall and square-chinned, though unshaven and somewhat unkempt.
And who, pray, are you?
My name is John Douglas.
Well, I'll be damned.
Gentlemen, which of your number is Dr. John Watson?
I am, sir.
Then, if I am not mistaken, you are the historian of this party.
Well,
I've not been idle while I've been cooped up in there. This manuscript tells the whole story. The story of the Valley of Fear. Take it. Read it. Use it, if you will. But whatever you do, believe it.
Why, indeed.
And, Mr. Holmes, I never thought that I'd have the honor and pleasure of meeting you in person, sir.
The pleasure's mine, Mr. Douglas.
Hey, one moment. This is all very touching, I'm sure. But I'm supposed to be investigating your death.
The only death that needs investigating, Mr. Mack, is the death of our missing cyclist. Mr. Douglas' assailant, is that not so?
I think you must have pieced the whole story together by now, Mr. Holmes. Go on. I will stop you if you are from the path of truth.
Consider for a moment the following scenario. 2 nights ago, Douglas here surprised an intruder and in the ensuing brawl killed him with his own gun. Partly to deceive the police, but more importantly to deceive other members of the organization which had sent this man to kill him, Douglas colluded with his wife and with Barker to make it appear as though he had been killed by an assailant who had managed to escape.
Good heaven.
The body was dressed in Douglas' clothes.
Though there was no way I could coax my wedding ring over my knuckle.
And Douglas himself hid in a secret cell, last used by Jacobean fugitives and admirably described in a modest little account of the building of the manor house, still purchasable, Inspector, for 1 penny from the local tobacconist.
Aye, no doubt, Mr. Holmes.
The rest of the details will be found, I am sure, in the manuscript now in Watson's possession.
Indeed.
Mr. Mack, Mr. White Mason, I bid you farewell. I leave you with my findings and with the task of sorting out the legal niceties of this most remarkable situation.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. I can't pretend I'm not sorry to see this one cleared up.
Indeed, indeed.
This case, Mr. White Mason, is far from being cleared up, as you put it.
What do you mean, Mr. Holmes?
Take my advice and be vigilant.
As soon as word gets out that you are still alive, there will be further danger for you. Moriarty will harry, and harry relentlessly.
Moriarty?
Oh, just one of Mr. Holmes's theories.
Mr. Douglas, you know where to find me.
As we took our farewells, Mrs. Douglas was fetched from her room, and our last picture of Burlston Manor that evening was of this beautiful and graceful woman in the arms of her husband. The mutual joy in their faces already tempered by anxiety and fear. Ames had the Douglas's trap sent for, and we set off once again for the Westville Arms. Holmes was quiet and pensive until we had almost reached the inn.
What fate might await Douglas now, I dread to think.
I'm sure that neither he nor Barker will suffer too harshly at the hands of British justice.
Oh, the British judiciary system is as fine as any in the world. It's the individuals who administer it who are the cause for concern. But incompetent judges, time-serving lawyers, and bone-headed police officers can be circumvented. It's the greater danger that is so disturbing. Am I still in the Valley of Fear?
Holmes and I settled down into our frugal and none too warm quarters, and I took out the manuscript that Jack Douglas had entrusted to me.
I think it best, Watson, if you were to read it to me. It would enable me to concentrate upon the detail of the narrative. And your reading does possess a certain clarity of diction and dramatic poise.
Well, if you say so, Holmes.
Even though your rendering of Mangan's A Ride Around the Parapet at Christmas did tend to drift inexorably towards vapid sentimentality. Proceed.
A brief account of events which took place in the Vermissa Valley, United States of America, between the years 1875 and 1876. If I describe the district known as Vermissa Valley as desolate and gloomy, made up as it is entirely of black, bare mountains and tangled, impenetrable forests, and then the township of Vermissa itself is even more depressing. At least in the valley there is a certain grandeur in the huge fires and drifting smoke, while the sprawling heaps of slag and cinder pay tribute to the strength and industry of the men who hew out the wealth of iron ore and coal that lies hidden under this inhospitable landscape. But the town shows a dead level of mean ugliness and squalor. The broad street has been churned up into a horrible, rutted paste of muddy snow. The sidewalks are narrow and uneven. The gas lamps serve only to highlight the grime and dirt that hangs on the fronts of a long line of wooden houses. It is a dark, cold and murky February evening in 1875. A small knot of men can be seen milling about outside the wooden shack that passes for the Vermissa railroad station. Their grimed faces and the safety helmets they carry mark them out as miners returning from a day's toil in the lower valley. There is, however, one man standing slightly apart from the rest. He is wearing travelling, not working clothes, and a closer inspection will reveal that his keen, shrewd eyes and firm jaw set him apart also. Set him apart as one who is likely to leave his mark, for good or evil, on whatever community he happens to dwell in. He glances quickly, perhaps wistfully, at the tiny mountain train making its way back down the valley. Then notices one of the miners shaking hands with a colleague. He picks up his bag and walks quickly over to him.
Excuse me, sir. I merely arrived from Chicago and looking for a decent lodging house. Can you suggest somewhere? It's a dark night.
Dark nights are unpleasant.
Yes, for strangers to travel.
A freeman of the ancient order is always welcome in Vermissa, brother. Make yourself known to the bodymaster, Councillor McGinty. Runs a bar on Main Street. As for lodgings, old Jacob Shafter is as cheap and honest as anyone in this town. His house is just 200 yards up the street. There. Lays back from the road a bit.
Thanks, brother.
Jacob Shafter is an elderly, heavy man of Swedish extraction. His tired eyes light up as the tall stranger fingers a bundle of banknotes. It is soon arranged that for the sum of $12 a week paid in advance, he is to receive board and lodging. And so it is a little later that evening that the newly arrived stranger makes his way through the chill and murky gloom of Main Street Vermissa to McGinty's bar.
Bartender. Bourbon.
Bourbon it is.
Could you tell me where I'd find one, Counselor McGinty?
Who wants him?
Name's McMurdo. John McMurdo, just out from Chicago.
Oh, is that a fact?
Wondered if I could have a word.
Sure. Here's a few words. Last train out of the valley tonight leaves in 10 minutes. Be on it.
And why should I?
We don't like strangers in this town.
But, dark nights are unpleasant.
Yes, for strangers to travel. The clouds are heavy.
Yes, a storm is approaching.
Over to the corner. Right, mister. We don't take folks on trust in these parts, nor believe all we're told, either. If you're found to be playing games with the lodge, you won't leave this town alive.
Well, this is some welcome for a bodymaster to give a stranger, brother.
There are too many strangers. Where and when were you made?
Lodge 29, Chicago, June 24th, 1872.
Bodymaster?
James H. Scott.
Mm-hmm. District ruler?
Bartholomew Wilson.
Why did you get out of Chicago?
Well?
Leave it. Over your shoulder. See? Oily-looking fellow just come in. Marvin, new police officer.
I've never been afraid of those dogs.
Evening, Counselor. It's a bad show about the smashing over that windlass and capstan over at Raisin Sturmish's mine, huh?
Yeah, well, perhaps you do better trying to find the culprit rather than coming here wasting my time on honest business, doing no good for his custom.
Well, if you happen to hear anything, Counselor, you know who... Well, now. Here's an old acquaintance. John McMurdo.
I was never a friend of yours or any other damn policeman.
I know a Chicago crook when I see one. It's only a week or so since I came out from Chicago myself. They still haven't forgotten about the shooting at Jonas Pinto up there.
You can't prove a thing.
Not yet. But it's a mighty shame you had to leave town in such a hurry. You should be a bit more careful of the company you keep, Counselor.
He didn't invite you into his bar, Captain.
You heard what the man said, Marvin.
I'll be keeping an eye on you, McMurdo.
Well, so it's Murdo that's down to you, is it, brother?
Yeah. Jonas Pinto is no loss. We was in business together.
Uh-huh. What sort of business?
I guess you'd call it manufacturing. We were helping Uncle Sam make dollars. Maybe the gold wasn't quite as good as his, but they looked as well. And were a damn sight cheaper to make. Then that damn blubber of Pinto squealed to the police and Pinkerton boys.
Oh, you're a coiner and a murderer. Oh, I'm thinking you could be a very useful recruit to our lodge, Brother McMurdo. Saturday night is our meeting. You'll be tested there.
And the stranger from Chicago is suddenly a stranger no more, but a marvel, a local hero. A man who has shot a squealer, who has coined successfully, and who dismisses a policeman with contempt, deserves to be courted, deserves to be bought drinks. It needed the more sober arm of Henry Morris to guide John McMurdo back to his lodging that night.
Yeah, the devil take them, Watson.
Holmes?
What does it all remind you of? The handshakes, the signs, the ridiculously banal, secret phrases.
Some sort of Freemasonry.
Exactly. And what a perfect tool for the criminal mind the secret society is. A perfect cloak that is capable of hiding anything, that can go on hiding more and more. Pray continue, Watson.
Next morning, John McMurdo rises early, apparently none the worse for the previous night's extravagances. He has a job to go to, a local bookkeeper's, fixed up for him the night before by, of course, Councillor McGinty. As he enters the downstairs front room, he is stopped almost speechless in his tracks.
Why, who?
I'm Eddie. Shafter. Mr. Shafter's daughter. Your breakfast is almost ready, Mr. McMurdo.
Well, thank you, Miss Shafter.
What do you think of Vermissa?
Well, when I arrived last night, I wasn't so sure. But now, well, I think it could suit me just fine.
Oh?
Yes, I've suddenly seen the unique charm and beauty of the place.
Your tongue knows how to flatter a woman, Mr. McMurdo. No doubt you've had plenty of practice. Now move your elbow so I can set this breakfast down.
Oh.
In that brief moment, something intangible has passed between these two young people. And so it is that as John McMurdo makes his way to the Freeman's Hall on the following Saturday evening, his mind, though filled with fears and anxieties as to the nature of the lodge's initiation rituals, still carries an image of the dark eyes, the flowing fair hair, and the warm features of Etty Shafter. A doorkeeper, with a golden green sash across his chest, fetches him into the room. At the head of a long table in the long, windowless room sits Bodymaster McGinty. On his head is a flat black velvet cap, and on his shoulders rests a purple stole.
Brother Scanlon, Brother Baldwin, bring the candidate forward. Candidate shall be trussed, blindfolded, and entered.
A rope is pulled tight round his shoulders and a thick black hood thrust roughly over his head. Through the pitch dark of the hood, John McMurdo hears the voice of Bodymaster McGinty strangely dull and distant.
Shall the candidate be tested?
And the frenzied reply.
Test him! Test him!
The strong arms of two worthy brethren grab McMurdo's own arms in a lock and propel him towards the roaring cold fire that is burning in the grate. Good God, Holmes, this is pretty gruesome stuff, do you not think?
I am more concerned by the appearance of the young woman.
Holmes.
Complications inevitably start to arise once a woman takes the stage.
You're still thinking of Miss Irene Adler and the Bohemian scandal?
I'm thinking that love is an emotional thing, opposed utterly to calculating reason, and therefore likely to play havoc with the best-laid plans of both policemen and criminals. A glass of port?
Yes, that would be most welcome.
Proceed, Watson, with what, if I may say so, is a most animated rendering of an extraordinary story.
At the moment John McMurdo feels his feet touching the grate of the crackling fire, the two brethren holding his arms suddenly jerk him back. He hears Bodymaster McGinty's voice above the din.
Brother Freeman! John McMurdo, are you already a brother in the ancient order of Freeman?
Made in Lodge 29, Chicago, June 24th, 1872.
Dark nights are unpleasant.
Yes, for strangers to travel.
The clouds are heavy.
Yes, a storm is approaching.
You know, brother, by your sign and countersign that you're one of us. We would have you know, however, that in this county and in other counties of these parts, we have certain rights and duties of our own which call for good men. Can you bear pain?
As well as another.
Brother Baldwin, the iron.
I can take more of that.
Oh, well said. You speak like a true free man, Brother McMurdo. You have sworn the oath of fidelity and secrecy. You are aware that the punishment for any breach of it is death?
I am.
Then, in the name of Lodge 341 Vermissor, I welcome you to its privileges and debates.
And suddenly the rope about his elbows is removed and the hood pulled from his head. He looks immediately at his right forearm, still burning painfully. Deep and red as the branding iron has left it is a clear-cut circle with a triangle in it. All around, he is being congratulated.
It's a fine show.
We've all had it, but not all as brave as you.
You've got a performance, brother.
I hope I can be a credit to the order, Brother Baldwin.
Credit has to be earned. There are some of us who have worked for this lodge for years who do not like pushy, loud-mouthed upstarts. I make myself clear.
It's never a pleasant thing to be threatened, however circumspectly. But young John McMurdo is not unduly worried. He thrives on challenge. He is building a new life for himself. He is the toast of the lodge, and he is in love.
Oh,
Etty, you are the most wonderful thing that has happened to me since I came to Vermissa. I want you, Etty.
Mr. McMurdo, you've only known me for a week.
A week, a day, an hour, what does it matter? I know what I feel, Etty, and I know what I see. A beauty, a tenderness, and a strength that I've not known in other women.
You Irishmen do have a way with words, though what kind of way I'd better not say.
Then follow your heart, Akrushla. It's me you want, isn't it? Isn't it?
I'm no innocent young girl, John. My father keeps a lodging house. I've met many men. You're different.
I am?
There's a warmth about you, about your eyes. I don't see it in the others.
Oh, then, Etty.
John.
No!
What is it?
My arm. It's a little sore.
Let me look.
No, it's all right.
No. John, not you two. You damn scoundrel.
Etty!
You're all the same. Don't touch me.
What is this racket?
See? The sign on his arm?
Why, sure, I'm a freeman. What's amiss with that? It's for charity and good fellowship.
It's for corruption and murder. Scourers, freemen, they're devils.
Oh, do you really believe all the lies you read in the newspapers?
I know. I know who runs the protection racket, keeps our land and businesses in the hands of a small body of men. Get out of my house! And don't ever come near my daughter again.
Eddie?
You heard what Father said. Go to your scourer friends.
And so it is that John McMurdo, his heart heavy and his arm still burning, makes his way to McGinty's bar.
Are you happier now that the good lady has made a hasty exit, Holmes?
I am never happy while secret societies remain secret. I wish to get at the truth. There are only two reasons why men go about their business in secret. Guilt and fear. He even hides his brand mark from her. Continue, Watson.
A number of the more supportive brethren suggest that they should all set out and do Shafter once and for all, but nothing actually comes of it. By the end of the evening, McMurdo finds himself the only lodger in a large house owned by an Irish widow on the outskirts of the town. His arm begins to heal too, so that the only blemish on his new life in Vermissa seems to be his disappointment in love. He has, however, other important matters to think about. For on the following Saturday evening, he attends his first lodge business meeting.
Dark nights are unpleasant.
Yes, the strange winds have traveled.
Clouds are heavy.
Yes, the storm is approaching.
Treasurer's report. Brother Haraway?
Our funds are in a very healthy condition at present. Firms of late have been generous. Max Linder and company have paid $500 to be left alone. The Walker brothers sent in $100. But I took the feeling of our last meeting into account in returning it and asking for $5. If I don't hear by Wednesday next, then it looks as if their winding gear may get out of order.
Thank you, Brother Haraway. Before we move on, I have an item which I would like to place before the meeting. Brothers, there's one man in this town that needs trimming up, and it's for you to see that he gets it. I'm speaking, of course, of James Stanger, editor of the Herald. Well, this is the latest piece of filth to be found in his slander sheet. Reign of terror in coal and steel district. 12 years have now passed since the first assassinations which prove the existence of a criminal organization in our midst. From that day, these outrages have never ceased until now they have reached a pitch which makes us the opprobrium of the civilized world. The men are known. The organization is patent and public. How long are we to endure it? Must we live forever in the valley of fear? Oh, poor. There, I surely read enough of the slush. He obviously needs to be given a pretty severe warning. Will you fix it, Baldwin?
Sure. I'll top him.
I don't want him killed. Just warned. So that he can be persuaded to print rather more truthful articles about the lodge. Who will you take?
Gower, Mansell, Scanlon, and the two Willoughbys. Yeah.
What think you of our ways, brother?
I like it well. 'Tis a proper place for a man with mettle.
What's that?
And your brother, sir, says he finds our ways to his taste.
I would say, worshipful master, that if any more men should be wanted, I should count it an honor to be chosen to help the lodge.
I would move that Brother McMurdo should wait
until it is the good pleasure of the Lodge to employ him.
Brother McMurdo, you're apt to push yourself forward rather too hard. However, you display an enthusiasm which should be a lesson to us all. You are not, after all, inexperienced in the matter for which Brother Baldwin has formed his team. I rule, as bodymaster, that it is the good pleasure of this lodge to employ you in this matter.
If that is the bodymaster's ruling...
It is.
Then Brother McMurdo will join the other brothers already named.
After the meeting, the little band who have been told off for duty gather together an arsenal of sticks and clubs and stroll out along the sidewalk in twos and threes so as not to provoke attention. The night is bitter, with a half-moon shining brilliantly in a frosty, star-spangled sky. In a large yard facing a high building which carries the words Vermissa Herald in gold lettering between its brightly lit windows, the pairs and threesomes gather with apparent aimlessness. The party cross the road and push open the door of the newspaper office.
Here, you, McMurdo, I want you out of the way. Stay and guard the door and see that the road's kept open for us. Willoughby will stay with you. The rest of you, come with me. His office is at the top of the stairs.
Help! Help me! Help! No!
Come on, Ted! That's enough!
You've got it coming, Stan.
Ted, we've done the job.
I haven't finished with him. Drop it, Baldwin. You'll kill the man.
Curse you. Who are you to interfere, Mr. Upstart? Stand back.
Stand back yourself. Or I'll blow your brains out. That's the lodge. Wasn't it the order of the bodymaster himself that the man was not to be killed? And what are you doing but killing him?
He's right, Ted.
For God's sakes, let's get out. The street's already been wakened. The police will be here any minute.
Come on. One day, McMurdo. One day.
Murdo included, break away into the side streets and so by devious paths to their own homes.
The tale unfolds in a familiar pattern, becomes clear. The Mormons, the Red Circle, the Ku Klux Klan.
American secret societies that we've had dealings with.
And the Molly Maguires, which we have not.
The Molly Maguires?
Originally formed in Ireland to resist paying high rents to absentee English landlords, then reformed in America to deal with unscrupulous coal owners.
So are our Scourers simply Molly Maguires?
No, but they may well have their roots in that organization. Put the ruthlessness of an organization like that together with rituals and secrecy of a Masonic nature, then add a sharp criminal mind, and you've got an organization far more dangerous, far more powerful than the Molly Maguires. 15 or 16 months ago, Watson, we found the Ku Klux Klan to be operating in, of all places, Horsham. If the tentacles of the Ku Klux Klan can reach Horsham, is it little wonder that the tentacles of the Scourers can touch Moriarty and Burlston Manor? Pray continue. Pray continue.
The next day, being Sunday, finds John McMurdo sitting in his room examining a few coins when he is aware of footsteps on the stairs.
Oh, so, Brother McMurdo, this your counting house?
I'm proud to see you here, Counselor. Will you take a whiskey?
Ah, I will.
This is indeed an honor that I hadn't expected.
I hear you, you pulled a gun on Brother Baldwin last night.
I did. And I'm not ashamed to say so.
Why? You're a real card, that's for sure. Why?
Our instructions were to give a lesson, not to kill. Baldwin was breaking those orders,
An order from a bodymaster must not be disobeyed.
You're never short of an answer, are you, McMurdo?
Where I come from, the bodymaster must always be obeyed. Else what happens to his authority and the discipline of the order?
The same applies in this lodge, brother.
Then you understand why I threatened Brother Baldwin.
Ah, Baldwin's ambitious. He looks forward to the day I step down. He has eyes on the office of bodymaster.
Ah, I see.
But maybe a future bodymaster should have greater regard for the rulings of the present bodymaster.
Hmm? Hey, wait there, McMurdo. Hey. And you too, Counselor. Cover him, patrolman, while I disarm him.
There's my pistol. Maybe, Captain Marvin, if you and I were alone and face to face, you would not take me so easily.
Where's your warrant? Breaking into the house of an honest, law-abiding man in this fashion?
Once a Chicago crook, always a Chicago crook.
And what exactly am I accused of?
Of being concerned in the beating up of James Stanger at the Herald office.
Well, if that's all you have against him, you can save yourself a deal of trouble by dropping it right now. This man was with me in my saloon playing poker up to midnight. And I can bring a dozen witnesses to prove it.
That's for the court to settle tomorrow. Come on, McMurdo.
Stand
away, Counselor. Right, I'll shoot if I have to.
As McMurdo is hauled roughly towards the doors by Captain Marvin and the patrolman, Counselor McGinty notices the young man's eyes glancing repeatedly and urgently, and his head nodding at a threadbare mat on the floor. Hardly has the sound of the policeman's heavy tread died away than the good Counselor has pulled the mat away eased up a loose floorboard. A few minutes later, he is to be seen sauntering along the main street towards his saloon, McMurdo's precious coining plant tucked safely under his jacket. Next day, in Vermissa Courthouse, John McMurdo is called to stand in the dock. He really has no need to raise the small finger on his right hand as he steps up, for the magistrate accepts the word of Councillor McGinty, the most prominent and active citizen, that the accused was playing cards with him at the time of the alleged incident, and in a matter of minutes dismisses the police case. And thus John McMurdo, self-confessed murderer, coiner, and abuser of policemen, now adds making a mockery of the court to his list of heroic deeds.
You kept a cool head, Brother McMurdo.
All thanks to you, Counselor.
And your little invention is in safekeeping, you'll be pleased to know.
Ah, good. I wouldn't want Marvin to get hold of that.
Oh, you certainly seem to know about counterfeiting.
Sure, it was a popular pastime in Chicago.
Well, I'm thinking you could put your talents to very useful purposes for the lodge.
It would be an honor, Counselor.
And so as spring turns into summer, a summer that is humid rather than hot and hazy rather than bright, the reputation of the newcomer from Chicago continues to grow. He is known as a boon companion, a cheery reveler, and withal a man of high temper who will not take an insult even from the all-powerful bodymaster himself. He takes it as an honor, therefore, to be called to one side one evening after a lodge meeting and invited by the bodymaster to visit him at his house, a large mansion just off Main Street, the very next evening.
Urban?
Thank you, Counselor.
I'll be straight with you, brother. I didn't invite you here for socializing. There's a job for you.
Are not such matters generally discussed at lodge meetings?
Usually, yes, but two brothers have been employed on this job before, and they've failed to carry it out. In fact, brother, too many jobs have been going wrong of late. Enemies of the lodge out when our boys have called on them. Equipment moved before it can be fixed. Somebody's tongue is wagging, perhaps.
Maybe you're right. And what is this job you have for me?
Chester Wilcox.
Oh, yes, I remember. He testified against two freemen in another county.
As a result of which they were sent to the gallows. If a lesson is not made of him, I fear other enemies of the lodge may be tempted to follow his example.
You say two brothers have been employed on the job already?
Last week. Hegarty and Davis lay in ambush for him, but he foiled them by returning home by another road. He knows the country around this farmstead like the back of his hand. That's why I think there's only one way to be sure of the job.
And what's that?
Raise the house.
But even though his wife and children will be in it as well.
Are you a true free man or not, Brother McMurdo?
By the end of the month, Counselor, you would have learned from the papers that your trust in me as a true freeman has been rewarded.
At the next lodge meeting, Bodymaster McGinty's announcement that McMurdo will carry out the attack on Chester Wilcox's house meets with wholehearted approval, except in one particular quarter. Ted Baldwin knows that his position of heir presumptive to the Bodymaster's chair is under threat. It does not help that, not wanting to risk trouble on an important and dangerous assignment like this, McMurdo chooses the Hickey brothers rather than Baldwin to assist him. Sitting alone in his room on the following Sunday afternoon, McMurdo is considering the possibility that Baldwin might well plan some sort of showdown or confrontation with him when he is aware of a footstep on the stair. He goes to the door and waits for it to open.
Right, doctor, you... Mary and Joseph, it's you.
Are you after trying to beat me up, too?
I hear a soft footstep on the stairs. The door to my room creaks open. What am I supposed to do? There are some dangerous men in this town, Nettie.
Oh, you should know all about that.
What are you doing here anyway? I thought you had vowed never to speak to me again.
I'm here against all reason, I suppose, but I couldn't leave without one last visit.
Look here, sit down. On my trunk here. It's not much of a throne for a princess like yourself. But it's all the furniture I've got.
Still the same flattering Irish tongue. I know what kind of life you lead, John. You're a murderer and a scourer. Well, it all comes to the same thing.
Oh, to be sure, that's a fine compliment.
Is it?
And what's all this about leaving?
In the past, my father's had his dealings with the members of the lodge. So have I.
Eddie, you don't have to tell me.
I tell you this so you can know how it is here in the valley. Both father and I have tried to break all contact with the lodge. That's why he was so eager to throw you out of the house. But it's impossible. That's why we're leaving for Missa next week.
But you can't. You both know too much about the workings of the lodge. It would not be safe for either of you.
It would be safer and better if you would come with us, John.
A murderer and a scourer.
You're different from the others I've known. I know it from the way you've looked at me, from the way you've touched me when we've been alone. You're a gentle and loving man at heart, John.
Oh, hush now. You'll have me drummed out of the lodge.
Oh, this place drags everybody down to its own infernal level. We can both get out of it, start afresh. Come with us next week.
I can't. Not yet. I must have time, Eddie. Why all the rush?
There's someone who's asked me to keep house for him.
Oh, mother of
Mary. He's the very worst kind of scour. There'll be trouble for both father and I if I stall him any longer.
Who is this man?
His name is Baldwin. Ted Baldwin.
Oh, leave Ted Baldwin to me. Oh, Eddie. Eddie, did you ever doubt that I loved you? From that very first day.
Then if that's the truth, John McMurdo, you come away.
I can't. Not yet. I cannot just leave Vermissa. I have important work to do for the lodge. It would put us both in great danger if I were just
to... And what is this precious work for which you're prepared to sacrifice the love of a woman you say you've loved from the very first day you met her?
I can't say.
No doubt you can't, but I expect Captain Marvin could.
Marvin?
He's been snooping around your lodgings of late. Don't you see? The police are closing in on you. Think carefully, John. My father and I leave Thursday. You have 4 days to decide.
And with those words, Miss Etty Shafter turns on her heel and leaves John McMurdo standing pensively in the middle of his sparsely furnished room.
Aha! What do we have here, Watson?
The climax to a remarkable story.
A passionate woman whose hasty ultimatums are threatening to endanger both herself and her lover.
Oh,
yet again we find an emotional attachment between a man and a woman becoming the fulcrum upon which the timing and the success of the denouement rests. Mark my words, Watson. The man McMurdo will find himself torn between conflicting actions, and we will witness a resulting terseness and urgency in the narrative. Pray continue.
In the early hours of the following Tuesday morning, the sky above the Iron Dyke crossroads turns red. Chester Wilcox's farmhouse lies in a crumpled heap like so much matchwood. John McMurdo steals back to his rooms and lies down on his bed, and the slightest hint of a smile can be seen curling about his lips.
Do you not already notice a shift of tone, Watson?
Next day, the afternoon edition of the Vermissa Herald carries the story on its front page. Horror of Latest Scourer Outrage is the headline under which Steve Wilson, special reporter, has described how the Wilcox house was blown up while Chester Wilcox, his wife, and two young children were asleep inside. Later that day, John McMurdo walks out into Main Street, pulling his thin jacket about him, for there is a distinct chill in the late summer evening. He walks down past the now familiar wooden shacks and follows a group of thick-set, hard-faced scourers into the Freeman's Hall. He enters the oppressive, windowless meeting room, feeling excited but tense.
Well, if it's not our young brother McMurdo, the legend of the lodge.
Brother Baldwin?
You have been keeping busy of late.
I am employed only in such matters as the bodymaster himself requests.
Oh, is that so?
I hear that you've been quite busy, Brother Baldwin.
Oh?
Busy pestering a certain young lady.
Oh, you've been poking your big Chicago nose into that corner, have you? Take a piece of advice from me. Find your own whore.
Why, son, Eddie Shuster's no whore! And she's much too good for the likes of you, Baldwin!
McMurdo! Baldwin! Brother Freeman! Is this any way to behave towards each other? Save your venom for the enemies of the lodge. Dark nights are unpleasant.
Yes, for strangers to travel.
Clouds are heavy.
Yes, the storm is approaching.
Brothers, before we move on to the formal business of the meeting, I'm sure the lodge would like to have recorded its thanks to our brethren here, and particularly Brother McMurdo, for their valuable work in upholding the honor of the lodge at Iron Dyke Crossroads last night. I'm sure you'll have read the report in the Herald.
Not time for another visit to old man Stanger, don't you think, Body Master?
Perhaps you would raise the subject the appropriate place during the meeting, Brother Baldwin.
Indeed, I will.
Treasurer's report. Brother Haraway?
Worshipful Master, I claim urgency.
Oh, Brother McMurdo, it is a claim that by the rules of this lodge takes precedence. We attend you.
Worshipful Master and brethren, notwithstanding the bodymaster's words concerning our success in dealing with Chester Wilcox last night, I regret to inform you all that I am the bearer of ill news.
What?
But it is better that it should be known and discussed than that a blow should fall upon us without warning, which would destroy us all. The bodymaster himself has mentioned the report in the Herald concerning last night's events at Iron Dyke Crossroads. As you can see, the report was written by a pressman named Steve Wilson. Brothers, I know this Steve Wilson. The last time I saw him, I was at the back of a public gallery in a Chicago courthouse, and Steve Wilson was in the witness box testifying for all he was worth against a number of worthy members of the Chicago Lodge. In fact, he is not a pressman at all. Nor is his real name Steve Wilson. He is none other than Birdie Edwards, the Pinkerton Agency's best detective. I knew that if we didn't strike against him quickly, all of us could very soon be behind bars. So this afternoon, I went to McGilligan's Bar, you know, where all the pressmen drink. And I happened to fall into conversation with Steve Wilson. He told me he wants to know all he can about the lodge and what he calls the Scourer outrages for the Chicago press.
Any brother uttering a word to him knows what is due to him.
I know that, Brother Baldwin. And I know there is only one cure for Mr. Birdie Edwards. To make sure he never leaves the valley.
Then we must go and fix him without delay. I already suspect there is a weak member or two in this lodge. A number of jobs have failed recently. We can't afford to let Birdie Edwards get to such men.
We could, if I knew where to find him. I couldn't get from him where he was lodging. However, I do have a plan.
Speak on, brother.
He told me he'd be at the telegraph office tomorrow morning, should I wish to talk to him. I meet him there. Tell him I'm a freeman myself, and that for a price, I'll offer all the secrets of the lodge. And he'll tell him there are papers and documents at my house, and that he should meet me there at 10 o'clock. He'll fall for it, I'm sure.
And then?
And then the rest is up to you, Counselor.
Brothers Baldwin, Cormac, Willoughby, Riley, and Mansell. This is the good pleasure of the lodge to employ you in this matter, and I shall attend to. We can get this man Edwards to talk, and discover if any of our weaker brethren have been foolish enough to talk. Brother McMurdo, you have already served this lodge well. We're further indebted to you for your prompt action in this most serious matter.
I trust we are in time to see the honor and ancient secrets of the order maintained. I am sure that after tomorrow, this town would have seen and heard the last of Mr. Birdie Edwards.
Until we have dealt with this man, brethren, be vigilant. The clouds are heavy.
Yes. A storm is approaching.
Next evening, John McMurdo makes preparations. He cleans, oils, and loads his Smith & Wesson revolver. He carefully surveys the room in which the detective is to be trapped.
Secret about secret, conspiracy upon conspiracy. How does an organization like this think about trapping its greatest adversary? By embroiling him in yet another secret. By spinning a further yarn of deceit and intrigue. It becomes, I suppose, a way of life. A mentality. Is the name not familiar, Watson?
Mm-hmm.
Edwards. Edwards. Birdie Edwards. Hardly a nomenclature that one is likely to forget now. Was it not in the time?
Holmes, I'm sure that if I'm allowed to continue my reading of the manuscript, we shall discover all in good time all that we need to know about Mr. Birdie Edwards.
Forgive me, Watson. It is simply that a half-remembered name is like an elusive clue or connection, demanding to be uncovered so that the picture can be made clear.
I would have thought the picture is clear.
Pray continue.
The large, sparsely furnished room has windows on two sides and a big stove at one end. John McMurdo sits in his only chair and waits. Just before 9 o'clock, Boss McGinty arrives.
Is he coming?
He is.
Good.
He's been promised details of everything I know about the Scourers. I even took his money.
The lodge owes you a debt for this. I guess when I move out of the chair, I can put a name to the man that's coming after me.
Well, Counselor, I'm little more than a raw recruit.
The normal custom of the lodge is followed, and the rest of the Scourers chosen to be employed in this particular matter arrive in pairs. First Baldwin and the Treasurer Haraway, then Willoughby and Cormac, Riley and Mansell. The whiskey bottle is passed round, and their host outlines the plan for the last time.
No one can see him come into the house after dark, and I'll lay to it that certainly no one will see him go. He arrives at 10. He is to tap 3 times. I let him in and lock the door behind him. He will be armed. Now, if I show him into a room with 7 men in it when he's expecting me to be alone, there's going to be trouble.
We don't want a noise going on so that every damn policeman in the town hears us.
Of course not. So this is how it works. I show him into the parlor next to the door. I come in here to get some papers. That will give me a chance of telling you how things are shaping. I go back to him and surprise him while his attention is taken with the papers.
It's a good plan, Brother McMurdo.
Let's hope you haven't forgotten anything, brother.
Everything is taken care of.
10 o'clock approaches, and the gathered company, aided by the natural effect of the stove and the whiskey, are feeling increasingly hot and uncomfortable. By 10:05, a restlessness has set in to which Brother Baldwin gives voice.
I don't think this Birdie Edwards is coming. I think Brother McMurdo has bitten off more than he can chew. Set us up!
For God's sake, keep silence, all of you!
Nothing can be heard save the quiet sizzling of the stove. The 7 men, their faces taut and expectant, wait. And continue to wait. It is nearing 10:15 when a sound reaches their ears which makes all 7 of these hard men flinch as one body.
It's him.
Quiet, you fool.
Hello?
good. You've come. Evening, McMurdo. Come in quickly, and everyone might see you. If you care to wait in the parlor, Wilson, I'll fetch those scholar papers I mentioned.
Right.
It's all right. He's fallen for it.
Oh, go on, McMurdo. Take those dirt papers out to him and get him through here. I want to take a good look at Mr. Bertie Edwards.
You're looking at him right now, Counselor. I am Bertie Edwards.
Marvin!
It's a trap! Hold it there, Bowman. I've orders to shoot on sight. Haynes!
They're all covered, Captain.
There are officers with rifles at every window, Counselor. Take that gun, Patrolman.
Come on.
Come on.
You filth, McMurdo.
The name's Edwards Baldwin. And I am from Chicago. And that's about the only thing I've told you about myself that's true. I was never a member of the Chicago Lodge. I never killed a man up there either. And I've never minted a dollar in my life. Those I gave you were as good as any others. But I've never spent money better.
Seven pale, rigid faces look up at Bertie Edwards. There is an unappeasable hatred in their eyes. He reads the relentless threat.
Yes, I pretended to you that the law was after me with the help of my old colleague, Captain Marvin, here. And I joined your infernal order and took my share in your council.
And you did your share of the dirty work.
The attack on old Stanger at the newspaper was the only job I was involved in that was outside my control. I had no time to warn him. But it was my hand, was it not, Baldwin, that saved him from death?
More's the pity.
I'd have you know, Captain Marvin, that this man is responsible for the death of Chester Wilcox and his family.
I think not.
Oh, then you'll hear different in court.
Chester Wilcox was more than willing to aid the plan to break your lodge, Counselor. He and his family moved out of the house the afternoon before the explosion. As soon as they hear about tonight's events, they will no doubt return to Vermissa.
But the reports...
Probably the only time Stanger has ever printed lies about Scour activities.
You're a fool to yourself, Edwards. Brothers, we have been betrayed by this traitor. And not only us here tonight, but the lodge, the district, the whole wider organization, the ancient order of freemen.
I never trusted him.
Neither did I.
And you failed us all in trusting him, Counselor.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
You're right, Baldwin. You were my most dangerous enemy. But you were also my unwitting assistant.
I was nothing of the sort.
If it hadn't been for your insane jealousy, which led you to make unwelcome advances to Etty Shafter, I would not have realized that my meetings with Captain Marvin had been observed. And the longer I waited, the greater would be the chance that I would be uncovered.
Baldwin... If you escape the hangman, you know what you must do.
Are you ready to leave, sir? The trap is waiting. We want to get this crowd safely away as soon as possible.
I'm ready, Captain.
It's not over yet, Edwards. The arm of the order stretches out east and west, to California and to Europe. You will never sleep easy in your bed, Edwards. Never. Remember, the storm clouds will gather once again. It is always a dark night for strangers to travel. You, above all people, will always be in the Valley of Fear.
Later that night, 50 or so other lodge members are arrested in various parts of the valley. For the first time in many years, the residents of the valley sleep peacefully in their beds. As soon as he has taken his farewells of Captain Marvin and his men, Bertie Edwards is sitting in the trap which is to take him to the station, and waiting there are Etty Shafter and her father. Together they board the tiny mountain train that Bertie Edwards had stepped down from on his arrival in Vermissa Valley one damp and dreary February night 7 months ago. The train makes its way down the valley and through the dark forests to the wide plain on the other side, where the three travelers join the busy night train for Chicago.
And so the conspiracy is uncovered by the efforts of a greater conspiracy. Justice of the poetic kind. I assume, Watson, that we both have a very broad idea of subsequent events.
Yes, but there is a postscript, if you'd like me to read it.
Proceed, Watson, for though I fear that this story has yet to reach its natural ending, a postscript will nevertheless bring us comprehensively up to date.
As a result of Birdie Edwards' work, the network of organized and institutionalized crime in Vermissa was broken. Councillor McGinty was sent to the gallows. The other ringleaders, Ted Baldwin amongst them, were sent to the state penitentiary for periods of between 10 and 20 years. As for Birdie Edwards himself, he has indeed never been out of the Valley of Fear. No sooner had he and Etty married than they were forced to flee Chicago for California. After several unsettled months, Etty became ill and died. For some months, Edwards drifted from township to township until he met up with an Englishman named Barker, changed his own name to Douglas, and started to prospect for gold in a remote mine. At about the time he reckoned some of the lodge were due for release, he set sail for England. He remarried, and for 5 years lived the life of a Sussex country squire. That is, until one morning in January 1889, when he saw a cyclist pushing a Rudge Whitworth bicycle up Mount Ephraim Hill in Tunbridge Wells. Despite the aging process of 10 years, he recognized the man immediately. It was Ted Baldwin.
And he stops then?
He stops there. I suppose that when he wrote that, he still trusted that he would not be discovered. Mm. It's an extraordinary piece of writing. Such imagination and drama.
A shade too florid in a number of places for my taste. But whatever Mr. Birdie Edwards, alias Mr. John Douglas, qualities of penmanship, there is no doubt that he is a remarkable detective.
Well, he got his man in the end. I mean, I assume the body on the floor was that of Ted Baldwin.
Oh, no doubt about it. It would explain the brand mark on his arm.
Well, that's that one tied up, then.
Oh, I think I could do with a good night's sleep, Holmes. What's left of it?
That one's tied up. Oh, yes. The brand mark, the bicycle, the dumbbell. It's all tied up. The case is completely and utterly solved.
Thanks to you, Holmes.
And how satisfied do you think I feel that this case is, as you put it, tied up? Do I have the countenance of one whose patient, thorough scientific detection has led to the solving of an evil murder? At the end of a successful case, Watson, in what activity am I most likely to be discovered?
Smoking a pipe of tobacco.
Smoking a pipe of tobacco. Playing my violin. Making notes towards the publication of some small monograph. Content with the satisfaction of knowing that through my detective skills, I have played some part in seeing justice done. In seeing problems solved, in seeing truths which the guilty and powerful wish to remain hidden, uncovered. And what has been achieved in the solving of this particular case, Watson? The arrest and possible conviction of a notable fellow professional for the killing in self-defense of a notorious thug, murderer, and blackmailer.
Holmes, you cannot blame yourself.
Putting a good man, his wife, and friend in great danger. Giving comfort and solace to all scourers in general, and to Moriarty in particular. Moriarty. Who else would Baldwin and an organization as malevolent as the Scourers have contacted for assistance in tracking Douglas down in England? If only Porlock's letter had arrived earlier, I could have perhaps helped Douglas and his wife. Perhaps, Watson, it is provident that we are still in Sussex and not back in London.
Surely it's all a matter for the judiciary now, Holmes.
I accept there is no more work for us to do in the way of detection, Watson. But there are a few practical matters where I believe I could be of some assistance. I would endeavour to get some sleep if I were you. For tomorrow is likely to be another long and tiring day.
I slept little. At the time, I was apt to blame the Spartan nature of the accommodation. The Westville Arms was only a marginal improvement upon what I'd been used to during my army days in Afghanistan. I suspect, though, that something of Holmes' depressed and anxious state had transferred itself to me. Next morning, we partook of what passed as breakfast in this most frugal of English inns, and set off immediately for Burlston Manor. The chill night had produced a heavy frost, though the gables and battlements were silhouetted against a hazy morning sun. The local police force was still in evidence at the manor, but we had no difficulty in being admitted. Ames showed us into the library, where we were soon joined by Douglas, his wife, and Barker.
Have you read the manuscript?
Dr. Watson read it all to me last night. It was an extraordinarily well-conceived plan. It would certainly have fooled the police. The scar of brand mark on the arm of the body seemed to be such a conclusive identification.
The only time I've ever been grateful for the cursed thing.
Believe me, Douglas, when I say that if I had known what I know now, I would cheerfully have steered White Mason and his men to Derby or East Ham or Tillicoultry in search of the phantom cyclist.
Well, to be honest, I doubt whether our plan would have fooled the Scourers or Moriarty for long. Baldwin would soon have been missed, and they are used to me returning from the dead. Don't forget that I have already been killed in a Californian gold mine accident and in a Chicago saloon bar brawl.
Yes, but it would have given you time.
Has the inspector or White Mason said anything about the likely charges?
We are all to appear before the police court later today. Mr. Barker and I are to be charged with obstructing the course of justice or something.
God, how I hate involving you both in my affairs like this.
Ah, well, a life of leisure never really suited me anyway.
Surely the English law takes into account the fact that Jack acted in self-defense.
Indeed it does. Justifiable homicide. Seat sua defendendo.
Self-defense.
Thank you, Watson. I penned a small monograph on the subject a few years ago. The crucial point is whether or not the judge can be convinced that Baldwin intended to kill your husband, Mrs. Douglas.
But surely that's obvious.
It might be to you or me, Barker, but not necessarily for a judge.
Or a jury.
Indeed. If the 12 men, good and true, display as much thought, foresight, and observation to the trial as their fellow countrymen did when seeking the phantom bicyclist.
Can you suggest something, Mr. Holmes? Could you perhaps recommend a good lawyer?
I rather think that the situation is beyond the call of lawyers.
But the police court today will surely only refer the case to the county assizes. That won't come up for another 3 weeks. Or a month at the earliest.
But Moriarty will be on your trail again. As soon as the midday editions of the papers are on the streets. Douglas, a rich and influential colleague of mine, Mr. Percival Hammond, would feel honored to act as your bail surety.
But how... I don't even know, Mr. Hammond.
Believe me, Douglas. His kind offer represents your only chance. Particularly as I have just seen Inspector Mack walk over your drawbridge a moment ago.
Inspector MacDonald for you, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Douglas. Mrs. Douglas.
Good morning,
Mr. Barker. Morning, Mr. Inspector. Holmes, Dr. Watson.
We were about to take our leave, Inspector. Watson and I have finished our work here. We must both return to London. Yet another call for assistance came our way this very morning. Isn't that so, Watson?
Yes, quite.
Ah, well, I'm glad I caught you both. Dr. Watson, that manuscript of Mr. Douglas, we shall need it in court, you know. It should tie up the last little details.
It answers the smaller queries right enough, but leaves the greater issues entirely unaddressed.
Oh, I'm sure that's nonsense, Mr. Holmes. If it hadn't been for you, we would never have solved this case at all.
Holmes sat in an intense, glowering silence all the way to the station. I wondered what new case Holmes had been referring to when he had spoken to Inspector MacDonald.
Well, Watson, goodbye.
But I thought we were going back to London.
Have no fear, Watson. I have not broken the law by willfully speaking an untruth to an inspector of the Metropolitan Police Force. We are both returning to London. But whereas you will return on this train, providing we do not stand here conversing for more than 2 minutes. I will return in 2 or 3 days. The branch line connection for Tunbridge Wells leaves from the other platform, I believe. Hurry along, Watson.
Next day, the newspapers reported the Douglas's appearance at the police court. The case had been duly referred to the county assizes. Bail had been stood by Mr. Percival Hammond. It was inevitable now that Moriarty would have heard about events at Burlston, and again Douglas's life would be in considerable danger. For 3 days, I heard no news, either of Douglas or Holmes. But that third day, I opened my copy of the Times to read of the disappearance of Mr. and Mrs. John Douglas and Mr. Cecil Barker, defendants in the forthcoming trial at East Sussex Assizes. The midday editions reported on a further development in the story. Mr. Percival Hammond, a surety for the Douglas's bail, could not be traced. That same evening, Holmes returned. I did not want nor need to ask him any questions. He took up his violin and began to play. It was a signal that yet another case was completed. He did not even complete the piece. It was as if, even at this stage, he feared the worst. We heard nothing for 3 weeks. Then one morning, a scruffy note was pushed through our letterbox.
Take a look at this, Watson.
Dear me, Mr. Holmes, dear me. A most singular greeting.
Greeting be damned, it's devilry. I had hoped... What good is hope against such organization, such power?
How can you be sure?
By going down to the city and making a check on the shipping registers.
Shall I?
No, no, no. I shall be back within the hour.
The nature of Holmes's efforts in Sussex were beginning to make themselves clear to me. He indeed returned, as promised, within the hour. He stood at the door, pale, the muscles in his face taut.
The steamship Palmyra docked at Cape Town yesterday. Passenger lost overboard in a gale off St. Helena. An American, name of Jack Rudge, traveling with his wife and an English companion, Mr. Whitworth.
Rudge? Whitworth? The Douglases and Barker?
Yes. Douglas chose the names. He was still trying to display his Celtic bravado. Barker was a frightened man, too. Didn't want to stay behind to face the police. So I had to arrange papers and passage for all three.
How on earth did you manage to do that?
Contacts.
Under the nose of the Sussex Constabulary?
Yes, and under the nose of Moriarty's agents, too, it would seem. For lost overboard. Reed thrown overboard.
Poor Douglas. Will I ever be out of the Valley of Fear? Will Bodymaster McGinty reach me yet?
Oh, you're a coiner and a murderer. Oh, I'm thinking you could be a very useful recruit to our lodge, Brother McMurdo. Saturday night is our meeting. You'll be tested.
Dark nights are unpleasant.
Yes, the strangers to travel.
The clouds are heavy.
Yes, a storm is approaching.
Well, we know, Brother, by your sign and countersign, you're one of us. Have you know, however, that in this county, in other counties of these parts, we have certain rights and duties of our own. It's called for good men. Can you bear pain?
As well as another.
Brother Baldwin. The iron.
Ugh!
I can take more of that.
Speak like a true free man, Brother McMurdo. You've sworn the oath of fidelity and secrecy. You are aware that the punishment for any breach of it is death. I am, then, in the name of Lodge 341 Vermissa, I welcome you to its privileges. You're apt to push yourself forward rather too hard. However, you display an enthusiasm which should be a lesson to us all. You are not, after all, inexperienced in the matter for which Brother Baldwin has formed his team. I rule, as bodymaster, that it is the good pleasure of this lodge to employ you in this matter.
If that is the bodymaster's ruling.
It is.
Then Brother McMurdo will join the other brothers already named.
One day, McMurdo. One day.
Remember, the storm clouds will gather once again. It is always a dark night for strangers to travel. You, above all people, will always be in the Valley of Fear.
The power of secrecy of a secret society is awesome indeed. It can hide anything. Anything. The rituals, the spurious sense of brotherhood are all attractive to men. They provide comfort and, above all, a sense of power. But when a secret society turns against the common good, those people who wish no part of it have to keep their notions secret. And in such an atmosphere of conspiracy will organizations like McGinty's and Moriarty's thrive and grow.
Do you mean to tell me that we have to sit down under this? Do you say that you can never get level with this king devil?
No, I don't say that. We have reached the end of this particular case, I'm afraid, and so has Moriarty. But the truth must be got at, and Moriarty trapped. Otherwise, none of us will ever be out of the Valley of Fear. But I must have time, Watson. I must have time.
We sat in silence for some minutes. Holmes' pipe lay on the mantelpiece unsmoked, and the violin lay upon the table unplayed, while those fateful eyes still strained to pierce the veil. This particular case was over, but another longer, more important, and more dangerous one had just begun.
The Valley of Fear by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was dramatized for radio by Roy Apps, with Tim Pigott-Smith as Sherlock Holmes, Andrew Hilton as Dr. Watson, James Aubrey as Douglas, and Lee Montague as McGinty. Others in the cast, Inspector MacDonald, Bob Doherty, White Mason, Edward D'Souza, Baker and Marvin, Trevor Nicholas, Mrs. Douglas, Natasha Pine, Baldwin, Andrew Branch, Etty, Edine Fogle, Mrs. Hudson, Val Lorraine, Shafter and Gower, John Church, Ames, Jared Morgan, Morris, Ronald Herdman, and Willoughby, Tom Carroll. The play was directed in Bristol by Brian Miller.